podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The Bishop and the Bear, the Bishop and the Bear, and to the delight of everyone, they are here to share jokes and rants and guests and things. Who knows what any fun they'll bring?
Not affiliated with the Mad Bishop and Bear pub at Paddington Station.
The Bishop and the Bear, bats beyond compare. Buckets of savoir faire, the Bishop and the Bear.
Welcome back again to, would you believe it's episode 66? If you have a plan to motor west, Route 66, we've made it. But what do we talk about this week in the Bishop and Bear, I wonder? Well, obviously, it's going to be the day Test cricket fought back, that unbelievable day when events in both Hyderabad and Brisbane captured the attention of the world of cricket, and temporarily perhaps everyone just forgot about T20 franchises for a while.
I've been forgetting about them for a long time, Tony.
Well, and of course we're going to look at that, and with that in mind, we're going to look at the events in at the Gabatoir, and we're going to have a little think about, not to have a go at KP, but he did send out a rather interesting tweet this week, balancing the challenges that make the life of cricket administrators fraught in terms of balancing short form cricket with Test cricket, when we see Test cricket being so amazing. Those are the things we're going to focus upon. Guests are our resident guerrilla news hound, Arian, who we're delighted to have with us as ever. How are you, Arian?
I'm doing well, Tony. How are you?
I'm good, and I need to get you a drink, so what can I get you?
Maybe a cold coffee would do.
A cold coffee.
Cold coffee, we can do that. We can do a
Frappuccino.
Which, I won't do the worry, sort of clunky, blowy noises that the coffee machines make, because unless Bear can magic that up in a soundtrack somewhere. And, well, who else but the spiritual brother of Harry and the grandson of Rupert. If I should die, think only this of me, there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever the West Indies. It is, of course, David Brook. Hello, Dave. How are you?
Hello to everyone. Hello, Tony.
Well, let's just crack into it with first of all, just some gut reactions to how we felt about the events on Saturday. Arian, Sunday.
Because I had to go off.
Day four of both matches was Sunday, was it? Yes, you're right. But you weren't there, were you?
Well, I was, and then I had to go about an hour before the end because I had to go to the football.
Yes, you were, because I had the day off, didn't I? I was the one going to football. Yes, of course. I actually listened to the final ball driving towards Vicarage Road.
Where you got a draw, didn't you?
We did. Anyway, that's by the by. So I'm going to start with Arian. Just some, well, for you, possibly not quite as exciting as for us, but you must have had to, what was your feeling as that sort of the denouement occurred in Hyderabad?
Yeah, it was phenomenal, Tony, to see a visiting team actually stick to their guns and employ baseball, and India coming a cropper on their home turf. It was phenomenal to watch, although not quite impressive as a home fan, but definitely interesting to see someone coming in with a clear strategy and sticking to what their plans are despite it going haywire in the first innings. It was really nice to see England coming back after conceding a 190 lead and turning the wheel on India.
So what's the general feeling in India? Is it sort of, if at one end of the scale it's a national disaster and we're going to, you know, sack the Prime Minister, and at the other end, well, it's only the first match and we'll be fine when Virat's back, you know, where really is sort of the Indian cricket lovers sitting, which is most of the country as far as I know?
Yeah, obviously it's a setback because we are not used to watching us getting beaten at home, and we've been infallible on our backyard for so long with Ashwin and Jadeja blowing teams away. So to see an opposition put pressure on both of us stalwarts, and you know, after the position they were in the game, so far behind, and then to post a total that ultimately proved out of reach, it was intimidating. But I think given the realism that India is also in transition with their batting, with so many new young people coming in and the old guards making way, there's an element of realism. We are not yet hitting the panic stations.
Well, we'll come on to selection in a while. I need to ask David, because you will have very much had your... Well, first of all, I need to know what you want to drink. I've got your usual rum ready. Will that be what you need, or are you going for something different today?
It's a touch early for me, but I'll take the risk.
Good man. Okay. On its way, then. It's the finest rum for you. You must have very much had your eyes on two places. Were you conflicted, or when push came to shove, where were you most focusing?
Oh, well, actually, I think the event, yeah, I mean, I was watching two games at the same time. And there were moments of high tension in both, never quite coincided. So it was kind of all right. India's run chase in the fourth innings was the thing that really interested me, was, you know, that it was very cautious, wasn't it? And moments where people lost their heads, but otherwise it was, you know, that it seemed very cautious approach. It's almost as though nobody wanted to make a mistake. I thought they would. Well, did we expect this to happen? No. Astonishing fight back by England, but the fallibility, as you say, of India's middle order was kind of palpable, and it's not going to get easier for them. And that really did hold the attention. It's just, how can a mindset like Stokes has put into England really affect a result like that? As for Pope, great innings. I don't think we realised it was a match-winning innings until he got past the century, probably. Potential match-winning innings. So many of his runs from the reverse sweep. And you think, right, will India have a way of countering that? Will the Brains Trust find a way of answering that? It seemed to take them all by surprise. So, yeah, lots of interest in both games, Tony.
Yeah, front foot well forward. He was able to sweep. Bear, you were calling it, and then you had to leave, didn't you?
Well, I did say beforehand to those naysayers like Jack and fucking Max on last week's show that Baswell will put a lot of pressure on India, because they're going out there with, you know, never say die attitude. And it's, you know, it fried Australia in the Ashes. You know, they never quite, I mean, they got away with a couple of wins. It could have quite easily gone England's way, and it was a very close series. But, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of teams don't like it. They don't like the pressure being put on them. And I think that's where Baswell comes into it, because teams don't, you know, India have never faced anyone who's come out and been that aggressive against Jadeja and Ashwin, as Arian said. And I mean, there are some interesting things I'd like to know from Arian, because I thought Rohit was so unproactive when England were batting. You know, there was no pressure on a batsman. And once Pope got past 100, of course, Axar dropped Pope on about 110. And then there was another chance much later when he was on 180, which would have made a big difference. But at the end of the day, he seemed to lose all hope in the field. It was like, we'll just wait for the wickets to happen. And when they happen, we'll have a total to chase. But when that got up to nearly 250, you know you're in trouble in a fourth inning. I mean, Dave says they were cautious, but that's what happens in a fourth innings, you know. 250, sometimes it feels short, sometimes it feels, when there's a partnership going, it feels like it's not very far away. But as soon as wickets start to fall, suddenly it looks a long way away, you know. And I thought India kind of got themselves in a bit of trouble and should have probably been more proactive when England were batting in that second inning.
Was it sort of a kind of paralysis, Arian? Was there sort of a, this shouldn't be happening, and then... Now it is happening, what do we do? Was there a sense of like confusion in the Indian ranks, do you think?
No, I would actually cut Rohit some slack, because pitted against baseball, it's unfamiliar territory for us as well. We've never been exposed to a situation where people are just coming at us and taking down the two of the best spinners the world has seen. So I think India are also learning on the fly how to have the field just right, so as to have catchers in the right place without bleeding too many runs. And there were nuggets in the first innings which told that India are actually being a slightly more defensive unit as far as bowling is concerned. Because when Duckett came out in the 2016-17 tour, there was no sweeper cover. But this time around, they had a sweeper cover and a man on the backward square leg right from the word go. And for Crawley as well, they had three men around the bat and three men on the fence. So it was about striking that balance where even if England go for those attacking shots, we don't concede too many runs. And I also witnessed some creative little ways in which India tried to offset Bazball. For example, like just zoning on Ashwin, everybody knew that there are going to be a lot of sweeps and reverse sweeps, because for as long as I've been watching cricket, sweep is known to be the last resort for a Western batter. And England obviously fancy imposing themselves under the current regime. And even guys like Joe Root, who can play with a straight bat and feel secure, still go for the horizontal bat sweep because it is a excellent run scoring option in the subcontinent. So it was obviously common knowledge that there were going to be a plethora of sweeps. So what Ashwin did was come closer to the stumps, bowl tighter lines, stump attacking channels, and with an eye on introducing more LBW. So it was a case of you miss, I hit. And it proved successful in the first innings, given how England folded. Obviously, it was an aberration in the second innings with England going on to post a competitive score. But there were ways in which Ashwin tried to neutralize Bazball by slowing down the pace every now and then so that the top edges can be introduced when batters are sweeping, and then firing it full to York, the premeditating sweeper. So I think India did their homework and there was decent execution in the first innings. But obviously, England stuck to their guns and came out blazing on all cylinders in the second innings to take the game away from us.
Some good thoughts there. So now I've got a question for Bear and David then, and you. If I look at Hyderabad and the five tests before, one draw, four wins for India, all of those four wins were by something runs, or an innings and something runs. Ergo, India batted first. When I look at Viscopatnam, and you're going to have to tell me how to say that in time for Friday, because I know I'm not saying it right. I think just two previous tests, India won by 200 something runs, one of those being against England, I think the other against South Africa. The main thing being, India batted first. Every one of the games they won in the test match venue just played at, and the one they're just going to. What, you know, at some point, David, England are going to lose a toss. How well they cope then?
Of course, the Stokes England unit likes to chase, doesn't it? It likes to see a target and go for it. So I'm not sure it will have as that big an impact. Although the rumours are, yes, the
Aryan, can you help us with
Aryan,
that?
Help us
a quick pronunciation lesson on, so we get it right come Friday.
Which word?
Well, there we are. The fact he doesn't even know what we're saying.
The ground we're playing at on Friday. Where are we playing on Friday?
Viscopatnam. Is it Viscopatnam?
It's Visakhapatnam.
Pardon? Visakhapatnam.
Visakhapatnam. Visakhapatnam. Visakhapatnam. You got to say it quickly. Yeah. Visakhapatnam. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. The suggestion is that it's going to turn more, particularly from day three onwards. So that will be a challenge for any team batting last on that. I mean, what can we expect from that pitch? And will the toss be as important as you're suggesting, Tony? I mean, I'm looking at the India batting line. We're probably not going to get on to previewing that test yet, but just looking at what the India batting order is going to be, it looks thin, doesn't it, for that next test match. I thought, looking back on that last test, Virat Kohli was really missed, not just as a batter, but also his presence on the field, the intensity. You know, would he have allowed anything like that to happen? Because Tony's right, the fielding and the captaincy was pretty passive.
But also left the TV director with a bit of a problem because they had no idea where to point the cameras.
Exactly.
Yeah, he ended up pointing at the lookalike, which is Siraj, as we just saw. Would that have happened if Kohli had been playing? It is a way of firing up the rest of his team. And the constant, you know, motivation that he provides. He was missed more than anyone.
I think you're right. In the middle order, I mean, Shubman Gill looks, you know, doesn't look happy, doesn't look in form, looks nervous, and that's never good for your number three, is it? And then, of course, there was no Kohli coming in at four. So I can't even remember who batted at four.
Rahul.
Rahul batted at four, which is probably a place too high. If he's not opening, he probably should be down at five. And there's no Ajinkya Rahane, he's not in the squad anymore. So suddenly you've got a very inexperienced side. Jadeja was coming in at six, no Pujara, exactly. So you're right, they are in transition. And at least if you had Kohli in that middle order, if you've got a couple of newbies, and so if you had KL Rahul, Rohit and Virat in that top five, you feel, well, there's three very experienced batsmen. Whereas actually, you've only got Rohit, who isn't a great amount of form either, and then KL coming in probably a place too high. There's a lot of inexperience, and you wonder how that gets on top. Jaiswal batted extraordinarily well in the first innings. I mean, he's Baseball for India, really, isn't he? I mean, he totally took Hartley to pieces. And on Hartley, I mean, Hartley learnt real quick, didn't he? I mean, he got tanked in the first innings, but you look at how he bowled in that first innings, and you look how he bowled in that second innings. In the first innings, he was constantly trying to drive into the pitch at 94 miles an hour, following Axar Patel. In the second innings, you watched his speeds. He varied it much more. I think probably because he didn't get hit straight from the off, so he was able to settle into a bit of a rhythm. But he varied his speeds. He was down in the low 80s all the way up to the mid 90s, and suddenly he found some rhythm. And I think on Indian pitches where there is assistance, if you can find that rhythm, you can put the batsman on the spot, not the other way around. And I think that's what Baswell does. As you say, I mean, Ashwin and Jadeja aren't used to be getting hit at four and five and over. They're used to going at one and two, holding a batsman down one end, playing them around the crease, drawing them forward, putting them back, and eventually getting a wicket, LBW, edged, whatever. And that, you know, that's what Baswell does. It does it to everybody. And it's a question of overcoming that. But it'll be interesting come Friday.
To Arian's point as well, the taking down of Hartley in the first innings was a very, dare one say it, Baseball mentality. Here is the new lad, first test, hardly plays for Lancashire. Let's show him what we're about. Boom, six over long on. I think if I recall, it was a smash back over his head. Nothing says welcome to Test cricket, son, like that shot. And yet, how well he came back. I mean, we might as well sort of go on to some of those, you know, the standout performances. And perhaps we should mix in the West Indies discussion at the same time. Otherwise, David will be sitting there going, well, are you going to talk about the magnificent Jamal Brooks at some point? Because to me, this magnificent super, it was Super Sunday then, wasn't it?
It was Super Sunday.
To borrow from Sky Sports. Super Sunday. You know, it seemed to be defined in so many ways by three people, didn't it? You had my ecclesiastical brother, the Bishop of Rome, who was absolutely magnificent. You had Hartley, who defied all the statistical odds and to just bowl, you know, 7 for 62, I think, just a phenomenal spell. And then, of course, you had the unbelievable Shamar Brooks, who just seems to be... Shamar Joseph, I beg your pardon. Shamar Joseph, who just seems to be like confidence on legs. I mean, he seems to be utterly fearless. And he only had one leg.
Yeah.
I mean, he could barely walk. Isn't he just got a PSL contract and he's had to miss out on some of that because he had a broken toe. So he did it with a badly bruised toe. Between actually bowling, he could barely walk. So you had these three unbelievable individual performances that define such an extraordinary day. So let's sort of see if we can think it through. Personally, I couldn't say any one of those performances was better than the other, because they all so materially affected the impact of both those matches, which by the most wonderful of coincidences were sort of happening simultaneously. Arian, could you sort of rank them at all, to think about how, you know, which one may have stood taller than the other?
I think it's a tight call, because all three, as you said, had a significant impact on the outcome of the game. But I think just the way Ollie Pope went about his business, defying the odds, and as Nijal mentioned, like putting Ashwin and Jadeja off their lengths, taking them away from their strengths, which is bowling six balls at a particular spot. And, you know, given the predicament England were in so far behind in the game, to put them in the ascendancy from there and allowing England to actually have a competitive score on the board, it was amazing. I think I would rank Ollie Pope's performance as the best out of the three.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because the other thing that struck me certainly for the two bowlers, perhaps. Well, no, certainly for Pope and Hartley, so those two, is they both come off the back of terrible starts. So in the case of Hartley, first ever test match, got absolutely mullered in the first innings. Exactly the right thing for India to do. Don't let him settle. Make it hard for him. It's, you know, we're not there to be lovely to everybody. We're there to win test matches, and that's what they did. Pope had an absolute shot. He literally looked like he couldn't remember which way up to hold the bat or how to move one foot in front of the other in the first inning.
Yeah, he was really skittish, wasn't he?
And yet. So possibly one of those two just because of the comeback factor. And yet at the same time, Shamar Joseph, it just seems so out of the blue. David, what about you? Could you rank those three?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, the fact that Joseph didn't even travel with the rest of the team to play that last fourth day because of his injury, and then yes, he appeared and we all thought, well, is he going to be able to bowl? And then to produce that spell with the joy and the belief, I suppose that's the common factor linking the two, is the sense of belief. You know, one in England, the way that Stokes and McCullum have instilled that in the England team, and then to see, you know, he virtually predicted that he would, you know, he said he would keep bowling until the end, until they won. And they did. It's one of those, you ask yourself, can it be sustained? Will it ever happen again with Joseph? And you feel, well, there is something special here. And it was because he was topping 90 miles an hour in that spell. In terms of ranking them, England victory wouldn't have been possible without Pope, without him, without that sort of score, and the West Indies victory wouldn't have been possible without Joseph. It's hard to call, isn't it? They were both amazing turnarounds, and to rank them almost defeats the object, saying they're both very special performances.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
That's sitting on the fence.
That's a left-arm spinner yourself. Oh. Where's your vote?
Yes.
Well, my vote
bears analysis as a left-arm spinner or something.
Well, my vote is with Pope, probably, because I do think that without that, I mean, he did get a couple of slices of luck, but without that, you don't get a total and you don't get anything to bowl at.
Definitely.
I mean, Joseph comes second because, I mean, it's a different match. So, I mean, in that match, he was clearly man of the match. I mean, that was a phenomenal point. I mean, they haven't won in Australia for 27 years. So, I mean, that's an incredible performance. And it's quite a weak West Indies side. So to be able to do that to Australia at Brisbane, at the Gabatoir, where they bloody never lose, is phenomenal. Let's be honest, you know. I mean, and Australia were cruising, weren't they? About 130 for two. And then he just took them apart. So, I mean, that's a phenomenal performance to win away. But for me, Pope. Hartley, now, we were just talking about Jadeja and Ashwin bowling their lengths, and this is what India allowed them to do by not being proactive when they batted second. They allowed Hartley, and this is what I always say, if you can bowl on a length in India and the wickets offer you assistance, you don't have to be the greatest bowler, I don't think. You've got to be able to find the right length and keep the batsman quiet, and opportunities will arise, and they kind of did. I mean, Jaiswal kind of got himself out, really, and he was the first to go, and then Gill went shortly afterwards, just a little prod on the outside, and that'll give Hartley A, some confidence, but B, suddenly India lost a couple of wickets and they then couldn't be proactive themselves, and that slowed them down and allows Hartley then to sit on a length.
Don't forget he had Pope at silly point, didn't he? Yeah. And what a difference that made. Pope's not only contributing with the bat.
Yeah. And so those things combined to allow Hartley to sit on a length, and therefore the kind of performance did itself. He's a left armer. You've got a predominance of right-handers in the side. I actually think Root bowled really well in that test, and I'd be interested if Leach was fit as to how they'd have gone in the next test. I think Leach is going to be out of the next test, and therefore they're probably, I don't know, I mean, I personally think you get more balance if you only had three, you don't need three spinners, you don't need four bloody spinners for crying out loud.
Well, they're muting it though.
Yeah, they are muting it, and I think it's daft. Although it's a Bishop Kapatnam, as we last time we saw, I think it was horrendous, wasn't it? It was all up and down and spun a mile and was bloody impossible to bat on. So maybe they know something we don't. I presume the wicket will be pretty similar this time around.
It's been a while though. 2016 and 2019 were the only two Test matches at Bishop Kapatnam.
Yeah, but. India will go all in, won't they? They'll go, we're better at spin. Presumably, this next test, they'll just go harder, as Dave Barrett would say, and make the pitch even more capricious.
Indian selection conundrums then. Just for what it's worth, I think if I was to rank the three, I think I would put Pope just above Hartley. The only reason for that being, a spinner takes wickets on a turning wicket because he gets the help from the wicket. A batsman has to fight that much harder against the wicket and the bowling. So, just for that reason alone, I would probably just say Pope, because without Pope, it wouldn't have mattered what Hartley did.
Did, exactly.
But when it comes to choosing between Pope and...
Jamal Joseph.
Why? It's because there is a Jamal Brooks, isn't there?
Yeah.
And then because I'm looking at Brooks in front of me on the screen, it's completely ruined my thread. But I genuinely couldn't choose between those two.
One question for Bear, Tony. How the transformation in Hartley, the fact that he didn't seem to be turning it much in the first innings, and then getting that prodigious turn, was that simply a function of the way he was bowling?
If you watched a lot of the slow-mos in the first innings, when he was bowling a lot of time with a scrambled seam, it didn't seem to be he was rotating the seam particularly much, and he was bowling really quite flat and quick. And so it wasn't giving it to grip. And that's the thing, if you actually watch Ryan Ahmed bowl, a lot of his balls are with scrambled seam. I don't know if they're doing that because they don't want it to turn too much because the wicket's too helpful. But if you watched Hartley in the second innings, you watch the slow-mos, he had the seam going correctly, it was rotating on the seam and it was biting on the pitch, and he slowed down his pace a lot to the mid-80s from the mid-90s in the second innings a lot of the time, and that allows the ball to dip a little bit, grip a little bit and do a little bit more. I think that was the difference, and that was mainly because he was allowed to develop into a spell and he wasn't taken down so quickly. I mean, Jaiswal tried it and got out, and then things changed. So,
and also the fact that the pitch had deteriorated a lot more going into the fourth innings.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, what is the pitch going to be like at Vishakhapatnam?
I think, Nigel, India would be shooting themselves in the foot if they go and prepare a rank turner again, because they will have to stick to their strengths and just try and beat England by doing what they do best. Because as we already discussed, India's batting, especially the middle order, is currently in a state of transition, with Shubman Gill, Shreyas Iyer struggling for runs, and Virat Kohli not being there. They're missing the services of Rishabh Pant, who can, you know, change the complexion of the game by producing innings like Yashasvi Jaiswal did in the first innings. So India would not be doing themselves any favours if they go and double down on the turn.
I think? But I think they will, though. That's my general impression, and the impression I get from reading the reports, that what England are expecting. They're expecting something that's even more of a rank turner, to be fair, which would be interesting. It's always a good game when there's a rank turner. Makes things interesting, I always think.
Well, no scoring game.
Let's ask Arian then about India's selection conundrums, because there's a few of them, aren't there? If you look at that batting when you've lost KL, are we going to see, I'm trying to think of the lad's name, the chunky fellow?
Zafraz Khan.
Is it Saurabh Kumar?
Kumar is the left-arm spinner.
No. Who am I thinking of?
Zafraz Khan, we just said.
Zafraz Khan, that's the fellow I'm thinking of. He's got a 300 in the Ranji Trophy.
Everyone has a 300 in a Ranji Trophy, as we all know.
Well, a bit like, yes, all right, okay. Who do you think he will get the nod, Arian? What do you reckon?
I think India would do well to bring in Rajat Patidar into the fold, because he is as close to a like-for-like replacement as you can get to Virat Kohli. Because I've been following his domestic exploits. I come from the same state as him, Madhya Pradesh. And he's one of those players who has this lazy elegance, an extra split second to play the ball, and has shots all around the ground, can take on the spinners and provide that little impetus which has been missing in India's innings in the middle order. When it comes to the left arm spinners void, I think Saurav Kumar would be an excellent fit, because he, just like Jadeja, is a metronome with accuracy and pace variations. So I don't think Sarfaraz Khan might make it to the squad. I think India would fill in Ravindra Jadeja and KL Rahul with Rajat Patidar and Saurav Kumar.
Okay.
And where does that
lead? You don't think the runs against India, England A, are going to help Sarfaraz Khan's case?
Rajat Patidar pips Sarfaraz to the post because he's got twin centuries against England Lions.
Okay. And Padikkal was originally in the squad, wasn't he, anyway, as well?
Yeah, but
he was in the first squad as well, wasn't he, Padikkal?
Yeah, so he's like...
Yeah, he was.
He hasn't been added, he was there already.
Exactly, yeah. So presumably he gets the spot, I'd have thought. It would be a bit odd to leapfrog him with someone you bring into the squad, I would think. Padikkal, he's an opener, and he's a lefty, isn't he? He opens in the IPL.
Yeah.
Saw him a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Made 100 on first-class debut for Madhya Pradesh, I think.
Has he played a test yet, Padikkal?
I do not.
No, he's uncapped in the test format, but he's been a regular in the India A format.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're right.
And just coming back to the Hartley conversation that we are having, I just find it very assuming that, obviously, England being a lot more cavalier, they just threw Hartley into the deep end in the first innings because they had the services of Jack Leach. So, do you think they would contemplate the decision to introduce Hartley with the new ball? Like, rather than entrusting the experienced campaigner that is Leach to kick off proceedings and then introducing Hartley around the 9th or 10th over mark when India introduced Jadeja and Ashwin, when the luster of the ball has wore off and there's more purchase from the surface, to maybe have avoided what Yashasvi Jaiswal did to him?
That is a really good question, David. I can see you're giving that some thought. What do you reckon?
Well, I think they'll do that. Yeah, I mean, Hartley will take a lot of confidence from what's happened now, so he'll just assume the role of senior spinner if Leach isn't playing, I guess. So I think that he would be given this head in the same way as he was in the last test. Yeah.
One would assume so, yeah. I mean, do we know if Leach is going to be playing? Or he's got a hematoma of the knee or something. Presumably is a pretty bad bruise.
Maybe they should graft Shamar Joseph's toe onto Jack Leach's leg with the dodgy knee, and we'll have some sort of Frankenstein ultimate bowling machine.
Yeah, because his introduction right with the new ball seemed quite interesting to me, because Hartley is someone who's still a rookie in first class cricket. Like, this was just his 21st appearance, and he has a lot of T20 experience under his belt, like 82 matches as Tony Bishop. He plays for Lancashire and Manchester Originals also, I presume.
Don't know who he plays for in the... Does he play in the 100? I never even bloody watched.
He played more cricket for Ormskirk at Hartley than he has for...
But I think it was an insight into England's philosophy of backing their players to the hilt, like in believing them they can get the job done.
Yeah, very much. He almost bowled that first spell like he was bowling in a T20. A lot of drag down. I mean, he got two wickets, but they were shit. I mean, they were half trackers that got smashed to cow corner's throat. You know, it wasn't like he did anything spectacular. It was both batsmen gave their wickets away to him in the first inning, so he got away with it, really. And at one point, he was going at like 9 or 10 and over, wasn't he? After about nine overs.
But Stokes just said, "Keep going, lad."
Yeah,
you'll
gave
get
him, gave him his head,
yeah. Which was just, you know, what a piece of captaincy. It is interesting, and I think this will interest David as well, because we are both huge lovers of county cricket. I suspect of the four of us sitting at the bar here, two of us love county cricket and two of us less so. one by dint of geographical distance and the other just because he doesn't. If you look at England's last three debutants, Josh Tung, he hadn't been having a particularly great season. Rehan Ahmed fits into the young guy, hardly played any county cricket. And then Tom Hartley, all of whom came straight into the team and took wickets at fivers in possibly each case, I think.
Yeah, Ryan Armour's was second innings, Hartley's was second innings. I don't know what Josh Chan's was.
And I mean, I often quote him because I think he's just a fabulous analyst and writer. There's a really interesting article by Mike Atherton in the Times, which was about how England rely more on data than they do on form. And they also have a kind of an approach which works sort of front to back. So in other words, they define the need of the team in terms of attributes, and then they use all of the data. And let's face it, you know, we're in a data-driven age. You can find out just about every stat you need, from dip, turn, pace, angle, you know, it's all. Absolutely, you've got the camera, the umpire's camera, you've got all of this.
Well, this is,
and that's how they then go, this is why we think Hartley's the right guy. They don't go 40 wickets, 50 wickets this season at about 20, he must be our guy because he's done well in the county championship. I don't think, David, that it implies, and I did, and maybe I think less so now, it doesn't imply a distrust of the county championship. It just implies a greater trust in data and kind of insight from data than it does on the conditions. It's more about the conditions, the context of when those wickets are taken.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm trying to unpick the difference between data and stats in that sense. But it's also that when you go back to the selection of Triscothic under Fletcher, it was a feeling that here's someone who can step up and perform a role, a particular role. I think that's what you're getting at. And that there's a hunch factor that they see someone bowling and thinking that they can offer what we're looking for. It Hartley was almost an Axar Patel kind of, you know, trying to match.
Well, that's what they said, wasn't it? They you know, that was precisely the reason they saw him as the Axar Patel of England, basically. Yeah. That's what we were told. But the interesting thing is, you say, Tone, yeah, they've got this new system, haven't they, in England, in first-class cricket?
It's where iHawk.
So every game is recorded kind of like Hawkeye,
right,
from the umpire's point of view. So they can get the data of every bowler in England, download it, see where their pitch map is, see how fast they're bowling, what their lines are like, what movement they're getting, and all that kind of stuff. They can get that, so they can analyse the data much better than just getting contemporaneous, this guy's good over at Lancashire, or this guy's good over in Yorkshire, or Durham, or wherever, from not having seen them. They can get that data and make a more informed choice as to who they're going to get. And plus, you've got to remember, England doesn't have spinners. So who the fuck are you going to go to anyway? You know, you've got to take a punt on somebody. I do believe Rehan Ahmed, they'll stick with Rehan Ahmed because I think he has potential. As a leg spinner, he's got great speed of arm over the top. He's got great control of length. They just need to get him. They need someone to get hold of him and get him to learn how to use the ball a little bit better, I think. But he's only 19, and so I think moving forward they should stick with him and he'll have his chances.
I mean, is the four ball and over on offer for him at the moment?
Yeah, well, you get that with leg spinners, you do. Yeah. But he needs to take more wickets, and for that he needs bigger spin, I think. But as I said, if you watched his balls, they were coming out of massive scrambled seams a lot of the time. It doesn't seem to have the, you know, you watch Shane Warne in his prime and the ball just like spinning top going down, you see the seam the whole time, lands on it, does what it does. You watch Rehan Ahmed, the steam's going all over the place, so he's not getting the bite and turn that he possibly should.
When
we speak about the selectors digging deep to find out obscure information, like release points and trajectories, this has been a work in progress when it comes to England cricket, because I remember even when Owen Morgan was at the helm, the selector chief, Ed Smith, these guys used to look out for these little bit of details that can be the X factor when it comes to playing a player ahead of someone. And A classic example of that was that they were able to decipher that when Sam Curran partners Anderson and Broad in the test side, their average is half combined.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, so the left-arm variety that Sam Curran brings, it is actually increasing the wicket-taking prospects of Broad and Anderson. So this is the level of depth they are able to achieve in their research process.
Interesting.
I can tell you it's 4,876 miles from Old Trafford to Hyderabad.
Nice.
But somebody it just shows you how different it is when you get there.
So
a question then, David. So Tom Hartley, let's say he does carry on, he takes that confidence, takes more wickets. Come next season, he's going to struggle to get a place still in the Lancashire side because they've invested quite heavily in an overseas spinner of no small repute, haven't they?
Well, if he's in so many test matches coming up, if he's in the England squad, he wouldn't play much county cricket anyway, I guess. So, and will Nathan Lyon arrive in time for the start of the season? I don't know if he's going to be there for the kickoff. So maybe Hartley will get a couple of games in then. But no, I agree. Lancashire haven't shown a lot of confidence in him as a four-day, as a red ball bowler, hence the signing of Nathan Lyon. So surely this has come as much of a surprise to them, Lancashire, as it has to the rest of us. I mean,
Well, I mean, I don't think he'll be in the squad next. You know, Leach is your main spinner. It's England, isn't it? You're only going to ever have one spinner in the side. I mean, Stokes likes having a spinner in the side. Maybe it'd be harsh on Leach having played 35 tests. And I do think he's a decent spin bowler now.
They both offer the same.
They do. And, you know, this is England. This is the problem. This is why we don't have spinners and why we're relying on Hartley in India. It's English wickets aren't conducive to spin. And therefore, you don't really use them.
The new processes and the new technologies and the millions of multiple data points you have to underpin that.
Do we get a look at Shoaib Bashir next?
Well, I think it would be, unless Jack Leach isn't fit, which is a real possibility, or England do say, do you know what, we're going all seam. In which case,
all spin.
I mean, the end of the day, spin.
All spin, yeah.
I don't know what's going on with me today. Mark Wood had a belligerent performance with the bat. I think I'm right. I don't think he got a wicket, did he?
No, he didn't.
The hope was that
Bumrah got six in comparison. Yeah.
They wanted to use him to rough up, particularly Axar Patel, didn't they? Because he doesn't like it up him, so it's Woody time. But the reality was, it was a pretty modest contribution across the 5 days. Although Woody, you're always stronger for his personality and he'll never let you down for effort. And he did what he had to do as best he could. But it might not be beyond the realms of possibility that they decide, well, we're just going to chuck Shoaib in there as well. And let's outspin India.
You've got to be pretty special, haven't you, to be able to take... I mean, if you look at Bumrah, was head and shoulders above anyone else with a ball of the pace bowlers. No one else really got the ball to do anything or trouble the batsman. But what did Bumrah got? Five or six in the game?
Six, exactly.
So, I mean...
He is something special, though, isn't he?
He is something special. He is phenomenal.
England has something called depth charts, apparently. That's what the underpins, the sort of the definition of the attributes required.
I this is it. I mean, if the pitch is turning, they might. The question is, if Stokes has had his operation, can he actually bowl? No one's indicated that he can. Because if he could, then you could go over four spinners and just say Stokes is your seamer every once in a while as captain.
Then you're leaving Anderson and Robinson carrying the drinks.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I would probably... For me, of all the bowlers who might prosper in India, I would probably go for Robinson. He's not the paciest, but he's got the height. And if there is invariable bounce, he gets good seam position, he does have a cutter. And of all the bowlers that England have got out there, if it's not Anderson, it would be Robinson for me. I mean, I think they just went for the pure pace. But I mean, if you watched Woody, he got a couple of overs, a reverse swing, but he got nothing off the seam. And the pitch was so slow, banging it in, and still bouncing before got through to what's his name behind us? That folks behind the stump. So you know.
Yeah, Anderson in contrast does get reverse swing, because if you guys remember the in-swinging pitches he bowled consecutively to Ajinkya Rahane and Shubman Gill on the last stop.
Yeah, exactly.
Knocking them through the gate.
Anderson's figures in India stack up pretty well.
Yeah, they do.
You could take other players famously, of course, and say less so. Chris Wokes being the most obvious example when you look at his figures in India versus figures at home. But Anderson takes his wickets at about 29, 30 odd in India, and he's taken plenty of them. It almost feels like you could pick any one of the seamers and it would be fine. My guts feel, and I'm, thank God for England's sake, I'm not the selector or coach, but you know, in football the analogy is, you know, don't change a winning team. I've got a feeling they would stick to what they have, having thought about it. I'd be kind of surprised if they didn't. What we really should do is move on to talk about Australia, and I really did want to cover that, Australia and the West Indies. David, I guess let's really focus with you on that one. Firstly, any idea what they put into the magic spray that went onto Shamar Joseph's toe?
It wasn't a one-off, was it? He had taken 5 foot in the first test.
He had.
Yeah.
Apparently we won't see a third deciding test, which is one of those great anomalies, two-test series. He's got that spirit and confidence and belief that comes at the start of a career. That spell of seven, you know, with the stumps flying out of the ground and the pace and the bounce that he was getting and carrying, was quite remarkable. I mean, there was some support. Alzawi Joseph bowled well, and Kemal Roach took three in the first innings.
He bowled very well in the first innings.
Yeah, he did. So, you know, obviously all the talk is, you know, West Indies are back, and the rest of it, which follows every victory. I don't want to deflate that.
And then proves to be completely wrong.
Yeah. Well, it usually does, yeah. I mean, the batting still looks pretty weak. De Silva and Hodge did very well to get them up to over 300 in the first innings. It was, but it was that one spell from Joseph was the difference. And it made some of the Australian batting look fallible for the first time. Usually someone comes off, don't they? There's usually, and Smith was there at the end, stranded.
Yeah, 91, wasn't he?
91, which I'm sure we all enjoyed seeing him stranded at that end. I mean, he had the opportunity to take it into his own hands and win the match, but he didn't. You'd have to say, could he have taken more of the strike? I think we should concentrate on fantastic performance in West Indies. Great to see the enthusiasm for Test cricket, and Joseph saying that given the choice of an IPL, IPL won't clash. If there was a clash between T20 and Test cricket, he's saying he will always choose Test cricket. I hope that turns out to be the case.
And someone offers him £500,000 to go and play some poxy tournament for 4 weeks in the UAE, and he'll go, oh yeah, thanks, I'll take that. You know.
Well. I mean, he's said it. We should embrace it. And it was one of the best spells we've seen since probably Jerome Taylor that took those seven against England back in the day. Or that's probably the one that springs to mind.
Carl Mayers, I think. Was it Carl Mayers? He took about seven against us when we were in the West Indies last time, didn't he? Those little divvy dobblers completely destroyed us.
David talks about his spell in Adelaide, it wasn't just another fifer, because he removed Steve Smith off his very first delivery.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he did. That's right. He did. What a! And his celebration is well worth watching as well. I mean, you mentioned his comment, David, which I think was interesting. You know, that commitment to Test cricket. Which was going to bring us on to the KP tweet rather nicely, actually. But, I mean, the thing I'd like to sort of ask you is, does it run risk of being a very brief false dawn? Or can Colin... Is it Colin Graves, isn't it? I seem to be mixing my names up. And the...
Justin?
No, the chairman of West Indies Cricket.
The president now is Keisha Shavak, isn't it? Who are you talking about there?
Somebody Graves.
Oh, Johnny Graves.
Johnny Graves.
The CEO, Johnny Graves.
Yeah. Confusing with the guy at Yorkshire. What really is the sad point for me, I think, is there isn't a third and deciding test. That, to me, is a tragedy when a series is so beautifully teed up with all kinds of interesting subplots. You know, Smith as opener, Shamar Joseph on fire with wickets. A third and deciding test would be phenomenal TV attraction, and yet, it doesn't get one. Cricket shooting itself in the foot, or is it just an economic necessity?
Yeah, two test series, you know, lots and more, and it's a great sort of, you know, two kids in a playground wouldn't do best of two. You know, to me, it doesn't make commercial sense because it takes the intrigue out of the series. If you look at it, another way of reading the numbers would say the cost of putting the test on and what they could be playing at the same time.
Didn't I hear, though, that West Indies were losing money by sending a team out to Australia?
Yeah, costing them about best part of $2 million to send a team there, and they're not getting anything like anything back. That's in terms of return from
it. Because the home team now keeps the revenue. Yeah. That was the change that was made.
Yeah.
It has to be, in answer to your question, Tony, about, you know, moving on to test cricket, it has to be some change that can be made in the distribution of funds to sort this out.
Yeah,
or the creation of windows. Because, you know, we're losing so many players now. Test cricket is losing so many players, either through being unavailable or premature retirement, whatever. And, you know, something has to be done. It's time for action.
Well, that brings us beautifully into... I'm just going to read that KP tweet. Sorry, go on, Bear.
I was going to say, let Arian have it. Arian, he wanted to say something coming there.
On, yeah, Arian. Tony, no. What makes two-match test series all the more baffling at the present is that since the turn of the century, there has been a significant decrease in the amount of drawn tests. So, which increases the possibility of having a 1-1 scoreline when you stage a two-game test series. So, at the turn of the century, we had around 24% drawn test games. And now it's come down to 6%. So, it is a knock-on effect of T20 cricket with the accelerated scoring rates and proliferation of wicket-taking chances. So, I think having a three-game test series makes more sense.
You had that absurd juxtaposition of West Indies getting that famous victory, followed by the presentation... immediately followed by the presentation of the trophy to the Australian team. It kind of made mess.
Because they retained it, I guess.
Yeah, presumably they retained it. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And also, you mentioned that trophy. It is worth saying it's the Frank Worrell trophy, right?
Mm.
100 years since his birth, am I also right?
Mm.
So in the 100th year of celebration, the West Indies produce a performance to honour him, which I think might have passed a few people by, but shouldn't have done to lovers of the history of the game.
Yeah, absolutely, very fitting.
If we just weigh the two-game test series with how the India series is tagged, like we have five tests. So at the moment, India have lost the first test, but nothing is cast in stone. We can still make a comeback. So when you have a long test series, it allows the team that has conceded the advantage to come back into the series and, you know, go on to take the honours. Because you learn, you assess, you evolve. But having a one-off test or just two tests restricts that possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's get on to KP, twat.
Right, well, I'm thinking of time. This could be lighting the fuse on a powder keg that we won't have time to watch explode. But I'm just going to read it. I'm not going to attempt to do it in a KP voice, but you know, you can imagine it in your heads what it sounds like. Okay. It's a fascinating discussion between the shortest format and test cricket. An argument can be had for saying that T20 has enabled a more entertaining test match arena. Also, it's just the old guard, that would be you and me, David, probably, who keep saying that T20, etc. are shite and we want more tests. What they don't realise is that the kids have zero interest in tests and the money in the game isn't coming from tests. My greatest format is tests. I love them more than anything, but I've moved with the times and realised that the future won't be tests for all nations. It just won't. I'm happy to hear people's opinions on this. also hear solutions on Test cricket's future, a constructive discussion instead of abuse of T20. Please. I have so much I want to say on that, but I'm going to keep quiet and I'm going to just ask for everyone's response. Arian's got a smile as the width of the Mersey Tunnel on his face, so I'm going to ask him first. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, there are a lot of truths inside that statement, because outside of the big three, finances are largely underlined by the franchise cricket, and I think it's up to the teams to prioritize Test cricket, because as we have seen in the recent times, South Africa recently named a depleted squad for the Test series in New Zealand, with almost the entire squad changing. So I think the onus has to be taken by the teams itself. And I read an interesting statement by Mark Butcher recently on the Wisden podcast. He said that the only thing that has been done to salvage Test cricket, which is the World Test Championship, has actually made it worse, because nobody is really interested in taking stock of what the points table looks like. So I think if the goalposts are not shifted every now and then in the WTC, it will help the casual watcher to keep track.
Well, you want my point of view?
Interestingly enough, I was going to come to you next there. So yes, we do.
Well, he's talking shit for a start, isn't he? You know, I mean, if you looked, well, I mean, presumably everyone who piled in on Twitter, if you watched the replies, it's about 90% were people telling him he was wrong. But then presumably there are people who always tell KP he's wrong. But, you know, there are many things you can do. That there are windows that should be made. I mean, this is it. This is where it comes down to, you know, the ICC becoming a body that's actually in charge of the bloody sport rather than just this sort of partnership thing. Someone has to impose something. There should be windows for T20 and there should be windows for Test cricket. I mean, the fact is there are three or four T20 competitions going on worldwide currently. If you've got 8 or 10 teams in each of those competitions, that's squads of 15. You've got to find all these players. That in itself dilutes the majority of these competitions, right? Or you're just putting up old stagers who are looking for, like the equivalent of benefit years. And therefore, the quality is going to drop in those particular competitions, and therefore no one's going to watch them. It seems that my personal view is a lot of these competitions are made for betting, actually. There's a massive betting market that's opened up in India, even though it's supposedly illegal. Obviously, that's their main sport. People love betting on it, same as people love betting on football in England. And the betting companies have probably realised this, and other people have seen opportunities. It's not about TV revenue. I mean, you look at the ILT20, no one's at the ground. No one's watching, as far as I can see, certainly not here. No one even knows about it on the TV. And therefore, it's all about something else, which isn't good for the game, personally. And I'll go back to my point I've been saying for about 10 years about how you make the World Test Championship work. And that is, you clear a summer every 2-4 years, don't care which it is, in India, Australia, whichever country has it. You have the top 8 teams go to a country for 3 months and you play knockout fucking rounds like you did a World Cup. Okay, it takes 3 months because it's Test cricket and everyone's got to recover, but it would be fucking fascinating if you had the top 8 teams go to South Africa or India or England over a summer and go, right, the first month, one's going to play 8, two's going to play 7, three's going to play da 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 da. And you have that down, you have the winners, you whittle that down to 4. Next month, you have semi-finals, and then in the final month, you have a 3-test series between the 2 top teams.
Gorilla Cricket as chosen broadcaster.
It would be fantastic.
I'm just off to the Caribbean for 3 months. So
Well, you know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, that would add something, wouldn't it? I mean, it would give a genuine world championship, a genuine World Cup, and a genuine, result at the end of it. And it would be brilliant.
You can also apply for press box accreditation, so I might also get a chance to fly to South Africa.
Yeah, there you go.
David, you've been commendably quiet and thoughtful, waiting your turn there. Is it possible to take the emotion out of anything that you when we respond to KP? But if you can, where do you kind of stand on that sort of challenge almost that he laid down?
Yeah, I mean, he set it up as an opposition between T20 and Test cricket. But actually, it's, as Arian was saying, it's franchise versus international cricket that is also the key touch point here. And it's the future of international cricket, isn't it? And because otherwise, without any windows or without the ICC stepping in, there are going to be more and more T20 and, yes, T10 competitions springing up. And if there are no, simply if there are no sanctions against players playing in those tournaments, representing and playing in international cricket, they'll continue to be attractive. So something needs to happen to protect the international game. And then Michael Atherton's point is the players need to respond. It's not just Shamar Joseph saying, Test cricket, I want to play Test cricket. Other people need to make their views clear as well.
Ben Stokes has done that.
Yeah, Ben Stokes, absolutely.
With action as well as words.
Yeah, Ben Stokes has done that. And, you know, that's, English players can probably afford to make that decision because the value of the central contracts are that much higher. Something needs to be done to stop the incentive to bowl four overs rather than, you know, to earn more money from four overs than it takes to play in a Test match. So international cricket is the thing that's at stake here. And perhaps, you know, reducing the number of T20 internationals and creating more space for the Tests. I mean, Bear's idea is, I've heard him say it before, is a fascinating one. And yeah, the WTC, as it stands at the moment, isn't working. It's hard to work out what the points table actually means. It's too complicated to get into decimal points and the rest of it. And it's led to a Future Tours programme, which is full of two Test series. As you say, that doesn't happen. How can that work in terms of deciding who the best
which
Test
is? Very unsatisfactory and unfulfilling, as we've just seen in Australia, haven't we?
I mean, the Test match crowds in India looked good to me. I mean, a lot of small kids there making up numbers. But, Arian, what did you think? To what extent has this caught the imagination in this first Test? Or is it the fact that India lost and we're going to see a reduction in the interest in India? And it seemed to be that it was playing centre stage in India.
Yeah, I think it was enthralling cricket. And I agree to a lot of points you said about how can you bring that intensity and competitiveness back to Test cricket. I think one of the first steps is having all the key players available because that automatically shoots up the competitiveness quotient. And Jason Holder, the West Indies captain, routinely advocates for more Tests for those involving outside the big three because that provides them an opportunity to show their skill. As we recently saw in Fortress Gabba, where players like Shamar Joseph can actually incite those who are no longer interested in watching Test cricket to tune up and watch the live broadcast and get engaged with Test cricket once again. There was a lovely picture, I think, of the England journalists in the press box at Hyderabad who had momentarily forgotten that there was a Test match going on in front of them, and all of them were glued to the screen of Cricinfo correspondent Vithush and Ayanta Raja, and they were actually watching history being created down under. So it was a testimony to how that sparkling performance from West Indies caught the fancy of the cricketing world.
Brilliant. There's a lot of things we've said there that have a common theme. I don't think it's a binary choice. I agree with the first sentence for KP. Yes, it probably has brought elements to Test cricket that weren't there before, but it absolutely shouldn't be a binary choice. It should be about a balance. I love lasagna, but I couldn't eat it 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch and dinner. The same is true of anything, of T20. They should and can work together. It's about a balance, and that balance and how to achieve it is the absolute remit of a game's governing body, not to just eat itself by pure financial greed at the expense of the good of the game. And the ICC have to be held accountable, would be my summary, and at the moment I don't think they are.
No,
if they want
not.
The short-term gratification, they're not taking an effective longer term.
Well, they don't have any real power, that's the problem, isn't it? But hey,
well, a governing body can't govern then, is a discussion for another day, because
it's a discussion that's happened a lot.
The Bear's got a builder to go and shout at. I'm sure David's got some students to go and educate, and Arian's got some fantastic articles to go and write. So between us, thank you for your company in the Bishop and Bear. As ever, it's time to head for home. We're going to be back on air on Friday, isn't it, Bear?
Yeah, this four week? In the morning.
Friday
joy.
Is four in the morning and the new day is dawning, as Farron Young once famously sung. Ariane, thank you.
Always a pleasure to speak to you, gentlemen.
Magnificent to have you at the bar. I hope you enjoyed your coffee. David, he'd probably sneaked in three or four more rums while he was quietly sharing his wisdom. Thank you to you. Thank you to the landlord, our landlord, for hosting us. And see you guys. Thank you so much.
And don't forget, you can patron us at patreon.com/gorillacricket if you really like us, because that's always helpful. Gorilla
Cricket. Revolutionary cricket commentary.
Sports Social Podcast Network.